Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth.
I truly believe that thoughts are the greatest vehicle to change.
We do not care whether the cat is black or white, as long as it can catch mice.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
When health is absent, wisdom cannot reveal itself. Art cannot manifest. Strength cannot fight. Wealth becomes useless, and intelligence cannot be applied, is a quote from Herophilus, the Alexandrian physician often called the father of anatomy. I thought this was an appropriate quote for our discussion today, as our guest heads an organization with a purpose centered on better health, to help their members make more informed healthcare decisions and live healthier lives. Our guest today is Mark Fitzgibbon, Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director of NIB Holdings Limited. Mark has been CEO of the group for over 18 years and led its demutualization and listing on the ASX in 2007. Today, the NIB Group is one of Australia's largest health insurers. Mark is also a Director of Private Healthcare Australia and has previously served as CEO of both the National and New South Wales peak industry bodies for licensed clubs, as well as holding several CEO positions in local government. Hello and welcome to another episode of No Limitations, a show where we speak to elite world-class performing men and women and unlock the secrets and influences that have shaped their destinies and that you could apply to your own life. I am your host, Greg Robinson, Managing Partner of Blenheim Partners, the number one research-led executive search and board advisory firm. In this episode, Mark shares with us his journey that has seen him become one of the longest-serving CEOs in Australia in one of the most complex and important sectors, healthcare. Always at the forefront of the debate, in this conversation, Mark presents healthcare in a new light, against a backdrop of historical perceptions, sharing with us a glimpse of the new world as we stand on the precipice of some of the most exciting changes the industry and the nation are about to see. So sit back and enjoy Never Get Comfortable. Mark, welcome to the show.
Pleased to be here.
Mark, what's the best part of growing up and living in the Hunter region?
Well, the Hunter's a big place. I grew up in one part of it called Cessnock. Mm-hmm. Mind you, I left home when I was 21, but my childhood was certainly in Cessnock. And, you know, it's a good place to grow up. It's urban, but you're in the bush, so, you know, you learn to do things that you do in the bush, like ride motorbikes and horses and camp out in the bush. Something I think which was an important part of growing up. And it's also very much a footy town, so play footy and do all the things that you know, young boys do.
Any good as a footballer?
Oh, I went all right. I played first grade for Cessnock and played lower grades for Cronulla back in the early 80s. But no, I probably lacked size as well as ability.
Fair enough.
But I love the game, and I still love the game.
Stepping stones in career.
Well, I went to uni from school full-time, and then all my buddies were working in coal mines and making lots of money, having cars and whatnot. So I thought, well, I'm not sure about full-time uni. So I sought for a job, and I got a job with the largest corporation in Cessnock, which happened to be the council. And over the course of the next 17 years, I worked for seven different councils, led three of them, including some big ones in Sydney, like Bankstown. And, it was a good grounding for my later career. Councils, although they're often much maligned, you know, they're very diverse and complex businesses. You know, you lead town planners and people who pick up waste and people who maintain parks and gardens through to sophisticated engineering. So it's complex and interesting in terms of its diversity. And it's also, they're generally very politically charged, which I think is an important part of our executive development, because you never escape politics.
And then how did you make the move from a career in the council to NIB?
Well, I was still a young man. I was running Bankstown Council, which, you know, employed a couple of thousand people at the age of 32 or 33, I think it was. And I just felt time for a change. And it was never going to be easy for somebody who came from running councils to enter the corporate world. And frankly, I got in touch with a headhunter at the time who subsequently became my agent and said, well, Mark, you're not going to be running BHP Billiton anytime soon, but we'll find a role for you which starts that transition.
Yeah, okay.
And he did. And so I ran an industry association, you know, the national, state and national club industry, which seemed a bit strange, but again, it was a time of reform. Like, my reputation in local government had been as a young Turk, a reformist. So I saw that as an opportunity and spent 4 years there through the Olympics. And, you know, we were a major sponsor of the Olympics. Again, a highly political environment. Essentially, I was a lobbyist. And then the opportunity, the same search firm put me into NIB way back in 2002. So, yeah, it was a bit of a clunky transition, but a fascinating one and one that has served me well since.
What's the lessons you learn, Mark, when you're dealing with people who are maybe been long-serving in councils or organisations who aren't necessarily willing to make the move and the young Turk comes through with the new ideas? Because that's a battle and a half, isn't it?
Well, I think education is a key. So not soon after finishing my local government qualifications, I did an MBA at a time when I was still emerging as a tick at the ride, so to speak. I think I finished my MBA back at UTS in the early 80s. I then started a PhD, and although I wasn't able to finish PhD for all sorts of personal reasons, I finished my Masters of Arts, so, you know, I had a double Masters. And I think education is really important, and I'm always encouraging people I mentor and, you know, our younger executives. I'm a big supporter of educational policies within the corporation. To continue to learn. I think lifetime learning is important. So that's been important.
Yeah.
I guess just pure ambition, Greg. Yeah. You know, you got to be ambitious to say, well, look, I'm not happy with where I'm at. You know, I want more. No, not in an egotistical way, but that's just who I and, you know, many others are. You have to be curious and ambition. And I suppose networks.
Yeah, right.
You know, as I mentioned, that particular search firm at the time became like an agent. Like a player's agent, if I was a footballer, you can't wait for opportunities to come to you. You've got to go after those kind of opportunities.
You made the move to NIB. You're still fairly young, building your career. What did you actually inherit, Mark? And also the second part, coming on board at a senior level, what did you promise the board you're going to deliver?
Well, part of the attraction to NIB was it was a Newcastle-based organisation company, and, you know, I like the idea of returning to Newcastle. NIB, or Newcastle Industrial Benefits, that's the acronym, had been a remarkably successful business over 50, 60 years. It had its genesis deep in the bowels of BHP, like many health funds or health insurers did. They were trade-based or professional-based organisations back then. So, you know, the guys who came before me had done a terrific job, but certainly I quickly saw an opportunity in the marketplace for NIB to extend its reach beyond the Hunter and become a national brand, and who knows, an international brand as we are today. We're the second largest health insurer in New Zealand, for example.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I sensed an opportunity very early on and assembled a highly capable team around me, and we just went after it. We had no real ambitions at the time to demutualize and list the company. You know, that came later. We simply had, part of our mantra was world domination. We just simply had ambitions to grow the business as best we can.
But was that ambition already in there, Mark, or did you instill it?
Oh, look, I'd like to think I instilled it. I think it was a very conservative organization back at the time. Like, women, for example, weren't allowed to wear slacks. There wasn't a woman in Kiwi in the management ranks or the board ranks. And that's just one dimension. But it was a very conservative organisation. Like the executive team went to lunch every Friday at a particular restaurant in Newcastle. In fact, the owner of that restaurant fronted me 6 months later to find out what he'd done wrong and why wasn't I going to his restaurant every Friday anymore. So it was a conservative organisation. It had done very well, but had got comfortable and was probably resting on its laurels. And you know, part of our culture is you never get comfortable. So, yeah, we're very ambitious and we aggressively went after the market. I think the industry had been rescued by, you know, the Howard government back in 96, and had Australian participation in health insurance had dropped to as low as 30%. Now, back before Gough Whitlam, it was 75%. So the industry was nosediving, and the Howard government reforms, lifted participation back towards something like 45%. We thought the industry had kind of gone to sleep on the back of that support. We did some numbers which suggested that the lifetime value of a new customer, a new policyholder, was much higher than the cost of acquiring a new customer. And so with that insight, we invested heavily in organic growth. And there was a period, I think the industry in 2003 collectively spent about $30 million on marketing acquisition. We spent that on our own in 2004, 2005. And we did very well. We really stimulated growth in the industry. And so that got it started. That was, in the mid-noughties. So doing our homework, preparing our minds, taking calculated risk and investing in that opportunity was, I suppose, the cornerstone of what really got us moving.
And what was your take on the industry? Was it a slow customers will come to us mentality? Was it just too relaxed?
Pretty much, it was a not-for-profit sector. You know, the largest health insurer in the market was a government department, as Medibank was back then. It's a very different beast today, of course. So, yeah, there was a level in my mind, there was a strong member ethos for sure, but, it was very comfortable. I can recall when we started, Greg, investing in advertising heavily around the state, two CEOs calling me wondering what on earth I was doing marketing in their turf, to speak. So you had there was that sense as well. So, we shook things up a bit.
And on the organic growth in your model, if I sign up as a 16, 17, 18, 19, 21-year-old, have you got me for life?
Oh, look, it depends. The average persistence or longevity of a policyholder is about 7 or 8 years. And, that varies. There's some people who've been with NIB for 70 years and, there are others who've been here and left in less than 1 year.
Change agenda, massive change agenda ahead of you, taking it from a mutual to a listed organisation. What's the story behind that and what's the learnings behind it?
Well, we very early bought into a philosophy. It sounds a bit cheesy, I'm sorry, but a philosophy that the status quo is death. If you just do the same thing week in, week out, year in, year out, you'll eventually be selected out in the marketplace. And, we have a theory that there's... Again, without getting too academic, I think one of the really interesting debates in management theory is do companies do well because of strategic choice? The strategic choice field would say, well, look, companies do very well who predict the future and set their sales on that future and execute perfectly. Or do they, over the course of time, do well because of a more deterministic view of the world that, look, they do they make good judgments, but basically the reason they succeed is they adapt to whatever market conditions and circumstances emerge. We're very much in that ladder, which is not to say we don't do our research, not to say we don't do a lot of strategic planning, but in our strategic plans is more like a roulette wheel. We don't place all our bets on one particular future scenario and process. So right from the very beginning, as we've looked at the business, we've thought, well, look, we need to experiment. And look, some of those experiments, some of those mutations, if you like, won't work, they'll be selected out, but some will. And if we're clever, we'll recognise those mutations that do well in this adaptive, deterministic world and amplify those investments and be sufficiently disciplined to cut off those experiments, those investments that that haven't worked. So if you think about our core business, our Australian residents health insurance business, even within that business, we've experimented widely. You know, we made that big investment in organic growth. We kind of pioneered this idea that you could custom build your level of health insurance cover. You could decide to self-insure for certain things or rely on Medicare. So we provide consumers with a level of choice. And again, you know, we had experienced operative in the business accusing us of selling us pretend insurance, but we'll say, no, we're just giving people a choice. And of course, now all the insurers offer choice today. We were the ones who, when the aggregators arrived to town, like the iSelex of the world that compare the markets, most of our competitors said, oh, look, don't go near them. You heard what happened in the UK. They'll steal your profits. We said, well, look, this is where consumers want to shop. We have to be there. We have to be on the train or under it, as I used to say. It was successful. We started the white label. People said, well, look, you know, if you start white labeling for Qantas or Suncorp, they'll eat your lunch at the end of the day. Well, we thought, no, this is a capability we can build and it'll be successful for us. So within our core business, we've always been experimenting and trying new things. Some haven't worked. And outside our core business, you know, we have a track record of, again, experimenting. You know, we entered the market for international students and the market for international workers. We went to New Zealand. You know, we have a joint venture in China. We now have a travel insurance business. Now, most of those, thankfully, have been successful experiments, but an experiment by definition isn't an experiment if you guarantee success. And we've had our failures. We had a medical cosmetic travel business, which didn't go well. Right. You know, we were selling DNA tests there at one point back in the late noughties. A bit of a question mark about our investment in travel insurance at the moment. So, you know, philosophically, we've been very deliberately pursuing innovation, experimentation in a disciplined way. And I make that point, a disciplined way, you know, because there are certain principles we apply for that. Firstly, there has to be a level of what we call relatedness to our core business. In other words, it's an economies of scope argument. We won't go after a business unless we can demonstrate we have certain capabilities and skills which lend themselves to this opportunity. So we won't buy a, you know, uranium mine, for example. The opportunity has to be big enough to warrant our intention. We call it pollen on the bum.
Pollen on the bum?
Well, it's based upon an anecdote that the way bees operate. So each state of reconnaissance bees go out in the field, and those which come back to the chief bees back in the hive with the most, they do a little dance, and those which have the most pollen coming off their bum, the chief boys bees say, these are the guys we have to follow tomorrow.
Makes sense.
We always, before we make a move on any innovation, we do a lot of research, borrowing Louis Pasteur's famous line about fortune favors a prepared mind. We talk about prepared minds. Like if I say to one of our managers, what's our prepared minds on this? You know, I expect, you know, a detailed analysis of the opportunity. And most importantly, fourthly, the innovation experiment, it's always a small bet. You know, you don't bet the farm on something new. You know, the deer doesn't suddenly grow a fifth leg to escape the faster cheetah. You know, we mutate our way with these experiments. So, you know, if HCF came on the market tomorrow and wanted us to pay $3 billion, would go to the market, raise the capital and buy it because it's just more of the same, it's core. But with a more novel opportunity, you know, we'll never invest, you know, maybe more than $100 million as we've demonstrated, you know, over the years.
Is there a DNA there that we're all in this together because we're based in Newcastle up against the big smoke?
No. All of our board today reside in metropolitan Sydney.
Yeah, but I'm winding it back when you started setting the targets and bringing that innovation through.
Greg, I'd like to say there's a Newcastle. Maybe there is some subconscious Newcastle thing to it. But I think the culture that I'm describing isn't Newcastle specific. And, you know, we don't think, although we love our local footy, and, you know, we're a major sponsor of the Newcastle Knights. Equally, we're a major sponsor of the Geelong Cats and the Auckland Blues in New Zealand. So we don't think, as much as we love Newcastle, we don't think through the prism of Newcastle anymore.
Fair enough.
And I don't think we did when I started. Like, you know, my first motivation was, you know, how do we create a national brand? You know, not how do we grow our market share in Newcastle. In fact, you know, we sold off a hospital which we just built on the basis of, look, you know, it's a form of vertical integration which may work in Hunter, but unless we're prepared to have a hospital in every market, it's not scalable. It doesn't make sense strategically.
The move to float, Mark, the move to float?
I'm not sure how much I can say. Well, look, I'll share this story. We were almost acquired back in.
Oh, okay.
Back in the mid-noughties. It didn't happen. And we were a bit disappointed because we saw it as a real opportunity for the business. You know, we're still only small, only 5% of the total marketplace. And with the failure of that merger through no fault of our own, we sat around the board table, and I think I said to the board, somebody said, well, what do we do now, Mark? I said, I don't know, we could float it, expecting they'd all go, oh, no, that's all too hard. And they were all excited about the prospect, so we floated it. It was that simple. And, you know, the core rationale behind that decision, you know, wasn't just for the fun of it, although that's always part of it, was that, you know, it'd allow us to raise the capital that we thought we'd need to raise to drive industry consolidation, M&A. Now, you know, it didn't quite play out that way in the end, and maybe we'll come to that a bit further on, but that was the principal reason.
So what is NIB today, Mark?
We're trying to be more a healthcare company with a mission in life above and beyond financial protection for people. So if you think about most healthcare systems, be they public or private, really we call them healthcare systems, but they're sick care systems. You know, they respond for us and consumers once we're already sick or injured. The future in our reckoning is very much that while protecting people once they're already sick and providing them access to the best doctors and hospitals, et cetera, will always remain important, the future will become more and more about our ability in helping you stay healthy in the first place, helping you and your doctors. And what's allowing us to aspire to that kind of vision for the company is the amazing advances we're seeing in data science, you know, big data, you know, artificial intelligence, IoT. So that increasingly with uncanny precision, we can say, look, if Greg has characteristics, biological, psychological, physical, socially, et cetera, we can, by comparing your profile with algorithms written from literally billions of people, say with some precision that Greg, because he has characteristics A, B, C, D, and E, is at risk of diseases 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 specifically. And if so, the best way to prevent or manage or treat those diseases is X, Y, Z. So this is the future. And, you know, given this thesis, we're keen to be as important to our members in helping them and their doctors understand their individual risk profile. And with that, providing with a range of, you know, goods and services and support mechanisms, which help them, as I say, mitigate that risk of disease. And of course, COVID-19 has, you know, taken this to another level. You know, people are much more aware of the risks associated with disease, be they communicable or non-communicable. And so it's fitting nicely. Don't get me wrong, nobody's celebrating the suffering and tragedy and misery of COVID-19, but it is really making more poignant this challenge, you know, we face as healthcare businesses to prevent and manage rather than just treat disease and injury. So it's a very exciting future. And our mission, we simplified 2 years ago now, well before COVID-19, our mission is your better health as a member. And there's no better example of the progress we're making than the JV we formed and announced last year with the global US-based healthcare company, Cigna.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Has it worked out well?
Well, it's early days, but it's working out well. You know, Cigna are bringing IP and IT to us through the joint venture, which will, you know, enable us to create the type of value proposition I've described, a value proposition which is about giving you a very sophisticated electronic health record and risk profile, the innovation that will allow us to hook you up seamlessly in this digital world with providers of, you know, disease prevention and management, not just of sickness. You know, the platform which will allow you to connect virtually with your providers. You know, I think it'll seem very strange to our grandkids and great-grandkids, maybe just our grandkids, that once upon a time when we're really sick, we saw a doctor in person, you know, given the risk of cross-infection, given a risk associated with sitting in a waiting room with a bunch of sick people. So, you know, where, you know, so much of our thinking is about how can we make this experience, this connectivity with the healthcare system for our members more digital, less physical. And of course, there's a huge democratization opportunity around that as well, being able to bring, you know, the same level of support and service to somebody living in Bourke as somebody living in, you know, Manly.
So how far away are we from reaching anywhere near that and those goals you just outlined?
Not as far as you may think.
So what's the roadblocks too?
Well, the major roadblock is that most of the spending in healthcare, like we spend in Australia $200 billion a year in our healthcare. Mm-hmm. Now, about 70% of that is controlled by government. And, you know, I'm not here to bag government. You know, I was operating government for 17 years of my life. But there's certainly not the spirit of innovation and risk-taking that's necessary to create this kind of world. So I fear while ever the public sector dominates any market, you know, you're not going to see the progress you might otherwise see. So inevitably, and there's a lot of forces driving this shift in any case, but inevitably we have to shift more responsibility for our healthcare system to the private sector and private settings. And, but that's probably a bigger debate. Getting back to your question, we're working on, so think of the value proposition. We're working on creating a health electronic record for you, a better one than what you'll get off from government at the moment, which is unfortunately not very user-friendly and clunky. And we're working on the algorithms. Many of these algorithms have already been written in places like the USA, and they simply need to be localized because there'll be differences associated with epidemiology and all climate and all sorts of factors which make, you know, your profile may be different to somebody who looks like you who lives in Minnesota. So that work's well advanced. We're already operating programs which is much about prevention and management around mental health and hospital discharge. So the largest program, Honeysuckle Health, I should have mentioned, is the new joint venture entity. That's its name. We're already delivering programs to members who, once they've left hospital, to manage them to avoid the risk of rehospitalization. About 7-8% of people who go to hospital end up being readmitted for all sorts of reasons. They forgot to take their pill or infection. So we're managing those we see as most at risk based upon the algorithms and data. The infrastructure, the insight, the support mechanisms like the nurses who ring you when you're getting out of hospital are already in place. And really it's about, you know, how we scale that up from here. Honeysuckle Health is a new company. We're 50-50 with Cigna, have NIB as its first client, its inaugural client and anchor client, but its charter is to pursue the similar type of relationships and arrangements with other health insurers and indeed public sector organisations.
So the model you're aspiring to, Mark, is there anyone in the world who's got, well, I guess which parts of the world do you think are leading the way? That's what we should work from.
Yeah, there's several. Probably, you know, probably, and Cigna don't like this analogy because they're fierce competitors in the US market, but probably the best example is United Healthcare. Yeah, so United Healthcare, for those listeners who aren't familiar with the company, are America's largest healthcare, you know, company insurer. They're, you know, $300 billion company. They created a sister company called Optum.
You're right.
Yeah, probably a decade or so ago now. And Optum provides the kind of services that I've described to, you know, numerous other American insurers and government programs. And Cigna are trying to do the same thing through, they announced last year, they bought a large pharmacy business called Express Scripts, which, and they've just rebranded that business Evernorth. So, you know, that's another comparison. Most health insurers try and do this within their existing company walls. The problem with that is these things need scale. Mm. You know, they need data from, as I mentioned, billions of records. Yep. They need scale to spread the cost of the investment and get the return of investment you need. And we have a well-established philosophy in the business, Greg, that the only form of long-term competitive advantage is constant short-term advantage. So, okay. You know, we're out of the box already with this kind of thinking. To the extent that we share that capability with other insurers in the future, well, good luck to them. They have to catch us now. And in any case, if we didn't share it, somebody else, you know, will enter the market and provide this kind of capability. You know, it might be United and Optum, for example.
Big gorilla in the room is the government, as you're talking about. So maybe we should tackle that a little bit. What are your thoughts regarding government's role in health? What's your thoughts on Medicare? And if you had the magic wand, what would you change?
Well, you know, it's an interesting debate. Australia's been a little bit falling between two stools on this policy issue for, you know, really since World War II. So, you know, in the trade, we talk about a spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, you have a single funder monopoly system like the NHS is in Britain. You know, it's called in the trade a beverage system, named after Lord Beveridge, who's credited with starting the NHS in England. At the other end of the spectrum, you have what we call managed competition, or a Bismarckian system, Otto von Bismarck, which is more a place where government stays out of the marketplace. It regulates but allows, you know, companies to form, compete for insurers, and you know, government doesn't get involved beyond redistributing income so nobody gets left behind and regulation. We've never been quite sure whether we want to be an NHS or managed competition model, and so it's ebbed and flowed depending upon whether it's been a Labor or Liberal government. So, you know, Gough Whitlam took us down the road of, you know, a beverage NHS type system. Fraser and others tried to bring us back. Bob Hawke then, you know, reinstituted Medibank, as it was.
That's right,
back
yeah.
then. So we've seen this ebb and flow, and it's been unfortunate, I think.
But of a population of our size, which way should we go?
Well, we should be gleaning more. A government's role in healthcare, as I think in any market, like, well, what is the role of government? It's correct market failure. There are forms of market failure in the healthcare market, such as information asymmetries, you know, the disadvantage consumers typically have with the sellers of healthcare products, and redistribute wealth or ensure nobody gets left behind. And I think the model we need to aspire to, and people that, so many people detest comparisons with the USA, but one thing they've got right with Obamacare is to outsource the delivery of publicly funded programs to the private sector. So just by way of explanation, there are two large social insurance programs in the USA. One is Medicare, which is just for the oldies. Now you can now, so 60, I'll say this with respect because I'm 62 this year.
The well experienced in society.
You can either buy the traditional Medicare product from government,
yep.
or you can opt out of Medicare and buy a private sector product. And almost half of Americans now have opted out of the default government Medicare product and bought private sector products because they're better. The other program is for basically people of lower socioeconomic status. That's called Medicaid. And really, really the big move with Obamacare and the ACA, Obama put hundreds and hundreds of millions more, billions more into Medicaid by lifting the threshold, the qualification. And they got another 50 million Americans insured under Medicaid. But that also imposed, Medicaid is actually a state-operated healthcare system, and it imposed additional obligations on the state who didn't have the money.
Yeah.
So the way it played out is, you know, clever private sector operators went to the governor of, say, Tennessee and said, hey, listen, Gov, your Medicaid population last year cost you $10 billion. Next year, our actuaries are confident they're going to cost you $12 billion, maybe more. Write us a check tomorrow for $10 billion, what you spent last year. Take yourself off risk. Set the performance outcomes for this population and we'll operate it for you. And Medicaid has been a wonderful success in the USA. So you still have government setting a policy and insisting upon the outcomes and funding it, but now they're off risk and the private sector is actually, you know, delivering it. It's been outsourced.
Okay.
But I think there's only two states now in the USA who haven't gone to the private sector to deliver their healthcare. So, you know, I dream of a future where government sees its role as regulation, funding healthcare to the extent that is necessary to ensure nobody gets left behind. So there's still universal coverage, you know, government insists upon that, but allows the private sector to provide the products and products which just aren't about financial protection and access to sickness services, but also products which are about actively helping you understand your risk profile, manage that risk profile, and hopefully prevent the risk of disease. And now, look, there are a couple of other imperatives behind this. The main one being, government outlays in healthcare. We get beat up for putting up premiums 3%, but government outlays in healthcare are consistently increasing at 6 to 7% per annum, and we have less taxpayers to pick up that bill. Like Greg, in 1973, when Gough Whitlam launched Medibank, as it was then known, there was over 10 working, tax-paying Australians for everyone. Sicker Australian. Yep. Today there's about 5 and a bit. By 2050 there's 3 and a bit. So you literally run out of taxpayers to sustain the current model. Inevitably, you have to look for solutions. Well, look, how can we lower the level of utilisation growth through being better at prevention and management? And how can we become more efficient by turning to the private sector to innovate and automate and digitise the entire system?
What about in different parts of the world too, Mark, where if I join a new company, get a new role, I get signed up or it's given to me as part of my package for myself or family, medical benefits, insurance, etc. It's not 101 here in Australia. It is in some organisations, but it's nowhere near as prevalent as it is in other parts of the world. Is that also something we should encourage or not?
Well, possibly. Look, most of those differences are historic. So the reason the USA have such a high incident of employer-provided health insurance is because during World War II, there was a wage freeze. So that, fringe benefits became a way of attracting, a scarce workforce.
Yep.
In New Zealand, about 50% of the market is sold through employees just because of their tradition. Here, it's only about 15%. We've mainly been a direct-to-consumer a business. That said, there is an opportunity there in Australia. We certainly see that opportunity. We acquired a business, a few years ago to amplify that particular channel, and it's done especially well. We think working with an employer creates a greater opportunity for us to more holistically, help our members, manage their healthcare, because there's another, influencer in there, that is the employer, to with the motives to improve health and well-being. So we like that market. It's interesting, in the USA though, that what they call the commercial market, about 80% of that commercial market is now self-insured.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because the costs were starting to get out of control. Yep. So what the health insurers have had to do, and this is consistent with the investment we're making in Honeysuckle Health, is they perform all the administration without taking the underwriting risk. So they still design the products, provide the service, pay the claims, negotiate the contracts with the provider of preventative and treatment services. So, there are very, many different models around the world. And even within that channel of employer-led healthcare, approaches do vary.
So how long is it going to take the government to change their mind? And who's going to stimulate that? Because it's been going, like you say, it's been ebbs and flows, ebbs and flows, ebbs and flows. And have we really advanced the discussion?
Yeah, well, look, any time I and others put my head up around some of this kind of thinking, there's a tendency to want to knock it off and suggest that, what Mark's really suggesting is, we kill off Medicare, which is not what I'm saying. I'm a Cessnock lad. Nobody believes. I grew up in a Labor household. Although some would argue I'm, probably right up Genghis Khan today, but I believe in universal health care. I absolutely believe that nobody should be left behind, as unfortunately about 40 million people in the USA still are. Yep. Still are. The problem with the USA system is largely around cost and equity.
Yep.
So we believe in universal health. All I'm on about is, how we deliver that outcome for everybody and how we make that outcome is good for somebody living in Bellevue Hill or Toorak as it is for somebody living in Bourke or Mildura.
Yep.
So we need to convince government that we can do it better, just as the operators in the USA have with Medicaid. So that's going to require a level of piloting and experimentation.
Okay.
We need government to believe that the status quo simply isn't sustainable because of the growing dependency ratio of old to young, and the need for some level of fiscal rectitude, particularly in the aftermath of the COVID-19 spending. We need to develop trust and relationships with the policymakers. There's an argument to say that only Labor has the license, the social license, and the trust to make serious changes to our healthcare system. And there's an element of truth to that, just like, you know, only Nixon could go to China thinking. And so I'm working, on the Labor side as best I can. But equally, both sides need to be convinced. And so, you know, for someone like Greg Hunt to lead this kind of thinking, A, he's got to feel as though he's just not going to be, there is going to be an element of bipartisanship about it, and it's a safe territory.
Yeah.
Firstly, he has to believe it himself. So, sowing these ideas with policymakers is part of my agenda. But probably more so, you've got to show how you're actually are doing it. So we have some ideas in the business that we're working on at the moment to demonstrate that, you know, we could actually wrap our arms around a specific population,
yes,
maybe a regional community,
yep,
and through the science, in a way I've described, through the predictive powers of data science and the new products and services we have to offer, that we can actually improve health outcomes in that community in a way which wouldn't otherwise be achieved.
Why wouldn't the Libs come on board with this? I understand you say you're going to go down and you're working closely with Labor, and you're having the chat on the Verse side, you're having the chat with Mr. Hunt. But surely it's got to make sense that both sides of the political divide have got to come together. Your argument's just logic, isn't it?
Well, it is, but...
when we talk politics,
what's logic got to do with it? Look, healthcare policy has long been the domain of the left, of Labor. And, you know, any time a conservative, you know, Liberal government has put their head up with... I'm not saying, and particularly, you know, the current Minister, Greg Hunt, who I believe has been fantastic, I'm not saying they haven't driven some important reforms in healthcare, but the kind of systemic change I'm talking about is major outsourcing, if you like. You know, even that word, outsourcing, well, it's two words, even those two words scare people. They're on a hiding to nothing unless they believe there's some acquiescence and acceptance on the other side that, look, it's worth at least an experiment or a pilot of some kind.
If you achieve these efficiencies and we get to the next level, obviously then you're people having a better understanding of their own health. Are my premiums going to come down?
No. No. So in Australia, we have this principle of community rating, which means that irrespective of your age or health status, you pay the same premium. So if you're 75 with all sorts of issues, you'll pay the same premiums as if you're 25 and fit and healthy.
Do you understand that? If I'm a 25-year-old or 21-year-old, 22-year-old, I'm super fit, I might be asking the kids, why are you stinging me? I'm not at the end of my active life, I'm at the beginning of it, and you're charging me the same bill. Why are you doing that?
That's a real issue.
Yeah, and it is for the young people. They must be, you know, because we're losing young people on insurance, are we?
Yeah, and one of these systems which create that parity across all funds is this curious system we call risk equalization, where basically the young subsidize the old inter-fund. And because we have such a young population, because we've been so successful in attracting younger people, we're a big contributor to that pool. So, look, it is a tax on young people, which is causing them to bail out,
yep,
unfortunately.
Yep.
And we need to redress that. And that's a policy change I'm prosecuting very hard at the moment. So watch this space. But I think more importantly, Greg, we have to shift the value proposition. The value proposition for my kids, and I've got four millennials, is it's got to expand beyond this notion that if I get sick, I need NIB. Like, that's important, but the reality of it is they think, well, yeah, but if I get sick, I'm probably not going to get sick because I'm young and healthy and I've got Medicare to fall back on.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we're going to change the value proposition to, look, if I join NIB,
yep,
They're there for me if I get sick, but more importantly, they're there providing with the deep insight and risk profile and goods and services which I need to make my stay healthy, to identify risk, prevent or manage that risk and stay healthy, and are providing with the kind of content which improves my health literacy, which is relevant to me. So our big agenda at the moment, which we call from payer to partner or P2P, is to change up the value proposition completely. So it's not just about your sickness, it is about your health, and it's relevant to you because it's about you, the individual, relying on the data science that we're bringing. So, you know, value is the two-part of equation. It's about cost, which everyone's very focused upon, of course.
Yes.
But it's also about what you get out of it. Like, nobody would complain about the cost of their health insurance premium if it included first class around the world ticket each year and free tickets to the Knights and Tigers and Blues games, etc. So we've got to create more value for younger people in particular.
Yeah, but you mentioned the word trust earlier. Someone for a young person, do I even understand my insurance policy? The words, you know, you open up an insurance policy, it's pretty complex. And then I actually think, okay, I'm crook, I've got to go and see the doctor and find out in subsection 3, paragraph A, whatever it's going to be, I don't tick the box. I thought I did. It's not that easy. Now, is there a need for far more education in that space?
Short answer is yes. And so at the sales process, yes. And I'm just looking at my phone now because I think it is easy.
Yeah, do you? Okay.
Well, look, if I go onto my fact sheet, all online, it's all there. What I'm covered for, what I'm not covered for. And kids, yeah, this is the way the new generations are learning everything these days. So, look, people will say, you know, I didn't see the small print. It's hard for me to understand what I'm covered for. And I can... Yeah, you know, it's a paradox of choice. When I started in the business, it was all vanilla. Great.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. And I mentioned this earlier. We made a very deliberate decision to create different levels of cover to suit consumer needs for them to assess. But by definition, with that choice, it's brought a level of complexity. And so, of course, we need to be as good as we possibly can in explaining cover at the sales point, or at any point of inquiry, and putting the information into the hands of our members. So I can, within that 30 seconds it took me then, get very, very clear about ticks and crosses, what's included and what's not included.
Mark, what did COVID really bring to you? And what did it bring to the Australian thinking about their health and their life?
It certainly brought an elevated level of awareness about the risk of disease and the need to prevent and as far as possible manage disease. And we're seeing that in our sales and retention. You know, we've had a good run since the again, nobody's celebrating the misery and disruption of COVID-19, but we've had a good run with sales and retention.
But is that good compared to industry, Mark, or is that good for NIB?
The industry's done a little bit better, and you know, we've done a little bit better than the industry, but that's just typical without wanting to sound like a wanker. You know, we have been growing, you know,
above
consistently
industry,
well ahead of industry for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly brought a greater emphasis on the kind of thinking that I've described, the need to invest in understanding the risk of disease, particularly at an individual level, and the most efficacious and cost-effective way of managing or preventing or treating those risks. It's certainly going to bring, and we're only just starting to see it, but it will come with a rush, more digital engagement between patients and doctors.
How's that going?
Well, it's early days. We're looking at a few investments at the moment. There's certainly been an uptick in virtual consultations, telehealth, you know, and government has supported that by making that Medicare rebatable. But it'll accelerate from here. You know, it's a bit of a long story. I was actually in Royal North Shore Hospital on Monday getting tested for diverticulitis. If anyone's ever had it, it's kind of an infection in your stomach and it's rotten.
Right.
But I was saying to the doctor, and he agreed completely at 9 p.m. on Monday night, that most of the diagnosis I received, which included a CT, constant blood and testing, it will all be done at home 10, 20 years from now, because we'll have the symptom checkers, the IoT devices, the 5G, which makes that possible. So we are going to see this this seminal shift away from where healthcare happens, and increasingly will happen in lower cost settings, including the home, because the technology will allow that. So, you know, COVID-19 is going to drive the confidence and investment in transition. And the other great consequence, which, you know, is a more general interest to your listeners, is this fundamental shift in work practice. And I say work practice very deliberately, because people think it's just about location. It's not just about location, although that's important. It's going, in order to, you know, if we're abandoning this Taylorist 19th century notion that we have to have line of sights of our people to lead and manage them, we still have to have other ways to set targets, coach, monitor progress, measure outputs. We've already adopted a policy at NIB that from here we have a distributed workforce. The office is no longer the default workforce. You can work wherever you want to work. That's your choice, provided A, it's safe, and we'll be checking for risk, workplace health and safety risk, and providing, including psychosocial risks. So, you know, for some people, they may not be able to work at home. So we need to provide a location for them, and providing technology works. And really, we'll have, you only come into work for specific reasons, such as training, induction, scrums, planning sessions, client meetings, although you can do that in a coffee shop in most cases these days. So that's our brand new operating philosophy, and we're putting much more stock in platforms such as Workday, which allow us to still, you know, have our workforce collaborate, communicate, you know, share ideas. People and setting goals and performance management.
You don't think you're breaking down, or is a chance of breaking down, the culture by having people working from home? There's an argument that, you know, people come, they move further and further away. I know you've got your video screens and everything else you're connecting to. I can tend to become a little bit more selfish, et cetera. You know, there's all these different arguments. And also there's the other big argument, you know, we are social animals ultimately. And it's great to run, you know, rub shoulders with our colleagues. But, you know, over to you. What's your thoughts on that?
Greg, I love this debate. I think it's one of the most fascinating debates we've had in my management career. There is that risk.
Absolutely, isn't there?
Because socialization, camaraderie, bonding, collaboration is just so important. And people talk about the lost water cooler moments. Okay.
Well, or the other one, what about I'm not going to win the grand final? If we all train separately, then came together once a week, am I?
Yeah, no, but that's different. It's like building a house. We're not going to build a house if we all stay home either. You know, we're talking about office knowledge work. And if, you know, if water cooler moments are so important, which I think they are, fine. Let's have a water cooler session every Monday for 3 hours from 9 to 12. Let's make that part of the way we roll. So I'm not suggesting for a moment that we don't come together, that we don't have locations for people to come together, and we'll have 5 hubs at this stage, but that we come together for specific purposes.
Yeah, right. Okay.
That we don't just come together because we come together. This idea that somehow, you know, corralling people into a office on level 18 in Government Macquarie Tower, 9 to 5 for 5 days a week, that drives camaraderie and collaboration. Look, it may, but it's not guaranteed. And so, you know, our philosophy is let's be clear about when we need to come together and make that easy and possible for people. Hey, but you know what? I could be wrong.
That's right. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. In 5 years' time, I could, as I often do, sit back and think, okay. We didn't quite get that right, and maybe the answer somewhere in between. One of the other interesting things, Greg, is we've done a lot of survey on this. 80% of our people like the idea, and I don't think it's because they're all slack, you know, wanting to slack off. In fact, our productivity is through the roof at the moment. I mentioned sales and retention, but that's true of, you know, our claims processing, our call times, et cetera. But there may be a Hawthorne effect associated with that, a certain level of novelty. So, you know, let's wait and see. But what I was going to say, our survey told us that on average, all of our people spend 5 weeks a year on the journey to work, stuck in cars, trains, and buses. Now, that's 5 weeks of productivity, or 5 weeks of playing golf, if you like, you know, as part of your work life.
Yeah, but don't you find when you sit in a room sometimes, or what? Okay, again, this is when you say you get together for your purpose. Let's talk about the success of NIB under your leadership. You've been innovating all the way through, haven't you? You're competitive all the way through. You've still got to create that. Now, can you create that attitude, that feeling, that innovative, you know? If I'm looking at a Zoom, that's okay. But when I'm in the room and someone's bouncing ideas off me pretty quickly, or that's when the best comes out of people, I think. But that's going to be when you get together for the particular purposes. Is that what the...
Sure. So you have an innovation day once a month, a water cooler day once a month, and without worrying about, oh, geez, I hope we're finishing soon because I've got to get to my next meeting, or without having to worry about the phone call or this or that. So we do need people to come together for all the reasons we understand. But let's build that into our mode of operation, our organizational design. Let's make that, you know, let's designate time and opportunity for people to do that. And the spontaneity would come with that.
Mark, through the process of COVID-19, are there any social or work-related or employment-related issues that's come out of the whole, I guess, awareness of COVID and the impact?
Yeah, I think another one I can think of, Greg, is I think COVID-19 is going to be a real page turn in the history of urban settlement. Like, technology is, it's actually not even COVID-19, it's around about technology. Technology is what took the pommies around the world in modern sail ships and steamships. It's what drove during the Industrial Revolution our migration from rural settlements into urban settlements very rapidly in the scheme of things. It's what built our suburbs because of the motor car and took people out of downtown and high-rise areas. And while COVID-19 has been the catalyst, it's really technology which is driving this notion I've already described about distributed working. And so we will see an increased proclivity amongst people to work in outside of metropolitan areas, basically, because now they have the technology and the means to do so. And we're seeing that already in the pattern of urban migration, quoting ABS data, which is showing a net migration out of Sydney and Melbourne. And, you know, I'm here in Newcastle at the moment, and I know all around the Hunter region, we're seeing a massive spike in home prices as people are escaping the cities because they can. So I think in the fullness of time, when we look back at the COVID-19 implications, net migration away from major metropolitan areas into regional areas is going to be one of the real shifts.
But are we going to see business actually step it up as well and move to the regions?
Absolutely. Consistent with the kind of vision we have for the company, yep. People aren't going to be collecting themselves in large office spaces in, you know, Sydney and Melbourne.
And look, and you've been a leader in the regions, Mark, but as a chief exec in the regions, is it much different to us city slickers being a CEO, you know, in getting one talent in the past, and you see that changing going forward?
Not anymore.
Yeah, okay, right.
Not anymore. Like, I work half Sydney, half Newcastle. So there's no difference for me, but there has been, and we've had to recruit out of Sydney and Newcastle. So half of my executive is in Sydney, well, almost half. We have Nick Freeman in Melbourne. We have another executive in Brisbane, Melissa. But now that geographic separation has become even less important in this new world of distributed working.
So exciting days ahead.
Yeah.
Leadership style then. Now, is that changing then? Is the way you operate changing?
Well, look, if you think about, what are the fundamentals of leadership? Having a very clear sense of purpose and vision for your company. I can communicate that at every opportunity. And in fact, I think, I was only saying to my partner, Rebecca, last night, she said, what are you going to do about the town halls? Which is when I come together with bigger groups. I said, I'm going to break it down. I'm going to have more town halls, but more at a business unit level, so I can get closer to the leaders within those groups. So, having a very clear sense of purpose and being able to articulate that with the people, I don't see that being impaired. Getting the right people on the bus, you know, to Jim Collins is 01, which is, you know, I still regard as, you know, one of the building blocks of any success. Yeah, that doesn't change. Encouraging a spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship, and now never allowing people to be comfortable with the status quo. In a way I've described, will still be driving that. Only be more episodic and maybe more deliberate. So, the one that worries me, it doesn't worry me, but I see as the real challenge is being very clear, being much more precise and organized about setting goals for people, monitoring progress, coaching progress, and managing results. You know, what's one thing that's become very clear to me as a result of COVID-19 is a lot of people who are coming to work, their output was they came to work.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, right.
You know, they must be producing output because they're here today between 9 and 5. And I think what COVID-19 has done, this change has done, it's through no fault of the people. Like, we're the ones who designed the jobs and gave them. For a lot of people, there's not a lot of output. So it's going to cause us to review a lot of our positions, whether they're still warranted or whether they can be shared or justified. And, you know, I think that's healthy for the company. And it's healthy for the people because nobody really wants. I suspect in all companies, there's a lot of people because of COVID-19 sitting at home today who really don't have a lot to do because they're not coming in the office anymore. They're not spending 2 hours on the bus or train even. So I think, you know, how we ensure that, you know, people have fulsome employment, meaningful work, clarity about what's expected of them, and support for delivering the results, I think they become even more important in this world.
If I'm starting out in my career, why do I go to NIB as opposed to others?
That's a good question. I think brand's important. I think brand's important with consumers, non-executive directors, regulators, leaders and staff. So I like to think we have some level of brand appeal. As sexy as you can be as a health insurance app, maybe we're at the upper end. The design of our recruitment process is important. It has to be sexy. Yep. It can't be old-fashioned.
So what's that look like? What's sexy about your recruitment process?
Oh, look, I suppose we're doing nothing. That's just the way we articulate, you know, what we're doing at NIB and what it means to be as part of NIB on LinkedIn and other platforms. Yeah, I'm not saying we're cutting edge on that, but I think we're probably at, you know, the top quartile in terms of the way we present ourselves to the world. Of course, the normal benefits. And I think most importantly, look, I don't want to overstate it, but we are trying to become, because everyone likes to say this, I know, but we are trying to be a technology company.
Well, you've got to be.
Yeah, the future of healthcare, as in so many other industries around technology. So, you know, we've just recruited a guy from Cigna out of Florida as part of our vision around data science and data-driven healthcare to come and work for us because, okay, we're not Amazon or we're not Apple, but, you know, what we're doing within the healthcare sector is, you know, pretty sexy and interesting and, you know, has enormous potential to change people's lives. So that vision, that strategy we're taking is hopefully, you know, attractive, to those who who have interest and see opportunity around technology in their career.
How long have you been CEO for?
I think 19 years in October.
Okay, so that puts you up as one of the longest serving CEOs in the country?
Yeah, but I'm still very immature.
No, what I was going to ask you next is, how do you stay on top of the game? And also, how do you make yourself, because, you know, some people lose ideas after a period of time, you know, 5-7 years, they're done their dash. 19 years, you just said, right? How do you know you're still on top of the game?
Yeah, I don't know. Look, I've known quite a few CEOs in my time have come and gone, and I don't know if it's because, Greg, they've done their dash. I just think there's this mindset that's evolved in recent years through corporate ranks that somehow you have a use-by date after 6 or 7 years. I think it's a little bit stupid, to be honest. you know, there were lots of men and women who are just building after 6 or 7 years. You know, they've done the hard work in terms of transformation, restructuring. They've now got their agenda in place, the right people on the bus, the, you know, the capital investments in place. And then the board decides, oh, you know, investors will look down at us, you know, if we have a CEO for longer than 6 or 7 years. I just think, and if we haven't have a succession plan in place, which means, you know, Johnny's has to replace Mary after 7 years, because that's our succession plan. You know, I think there's a lot of nonsense occurring on that front. But maybe that's just me making excuses for myself. But to your question, look, I'm as energized and as interested in the industry and its shape in the next 5, 10 and 20 years as I was 20 years ago. You know, I still bounce out of bed every day, keep fit. Look, I work differently perhaps than what I did 20 years ago, not because of a lack the energy I had then, but just because, you know, I'm probably even more out thinking about strategy and getting less involved in working in the business rather than on the business. So, but, you know, equally I recognise this, and the board know this, but I see succession planning for my own role as one of my important tasks from here. You know, I don't, you know, one of my legacies will be I left in place, you know, good leadership and a company in good shape. But, you know, I never think to myself, gee, Mark, you've been here too long.
Well, it sounds like too exciting a time to walk away, doesn't it?
Well, it is. And maybe this is the final chapter. You know, this whole notion about truly converting the company away, well, not away from, but building the company into a genuine healthcare company rather than, you know, what I locally describe as a sick care company.
What's your time limit on achieving that?
3 to 4 years, probably. Wow. Greg. Although yeah, you just never. It's so hard to predict these things. And again, you know, I waxed lyrical a little bit earlier, and sorry if I sounded a bit academic about this you know, this management question about economic determinism or strategic choice, the coined expressions. And so I'm very much a person that, look, you have to have multiple views about the future, both in business and your own personal life, but you have to be able to adapt to whatever. And so if in 5 years' time some new opportunity comes along and there's a reason to stay and it's exciting and rewarding, that's what I'll do. But on the other hand, if I've got to have a property up the valley, if I'd rather, you know, breed Angus bulls and that sounds more exciting, I might do that. But certainly what we're doing at the moment is going to, unless, you know, something were to go awry,
yep,
will, you know, keep me occupied for probably 4 or 5 years.
And if I was going to look up Mark Fitzgibbon after listening to this podcast, I'm going to come across his Instagram.
Fridays with Fitz.
Yeah, come on. That's interesting. What's the genesis behind that? and you seem to cover all topics.
Okay, so quick story. I'm sitting around on a Saturday night having dinner 2 years ago now, because that's how long I've been doing Fridays with Fitz. I think there's a couple hundred of episodes. And my children, who, by the way, have been very well educated, were lamenting the fact that Malcolm Turnbull had just been tipped out of the job and the guy they voted for. I said, guys, seriously, I said, none of you voted for Malcolm Turnbull. Yeah. I said, Malcolm Turnbull was appointed by the Queen on the advice of the Governor General, on the advice of the Parliament, who was controlled by the political party with the majority of seats. You didn't vote. And they were adamant. And their friends were there that they voted for Malcolm Turnbull.
No, he's not the president. Yet. He's not the president.
So so podcast I do every Friday called Fridays with Fitz. It goes for a minute, and I select some political or economic or business or social topic, which I talk for a minute about and offer an opinion, because you only get a minute on Instagram. And yeah, that's hard work, but it's become quite popular. I think I have 1,000. Followers.
Oh yeah, I saw you. I saw your advice around the U.S. election. You're spot on giving that prediction.
Yes, I said Biden would win easily, and people were poo-harring me on the night of the election. I said, "Well, you just hold your horses and wait and see." And but look, I think it's, you know.
Are you getting good feedback?
Yeah, yeah. No, I've band of followers and likes, and I'm generally, you know, the feedback's good. I take a very judicious approach to most, you know, issues. So, for example, in Australia Day, I talk about the history of settlement in Australia and the fact that it actually was an invasion. It was an invasion. And that we need to change. It doesn't mean we don't have Australia Day and we celebrate being one community, but we need to change state because it's offensive to a large part of our community. It's just as simple as that. So, you know, I try and tackle in a balanced and fair way, you know, some of the social issues that, you know, we older folk, I should speak for myself, you know, we have an obligation. You know, we've been on this planet, hopefully are a little bit wiser than our children to share our thoughts, even when we're wrong.
Well, I got you on a roll then. What are your thoughts in regards to the, I guess, the political debate in this country? And if you're going to make a prediction, are we going to see an election around August, September this year?
Yeah, I think most likely September or October. You know, the government appears to have some momentum. So, and they're generally regarded as having done a good job, particularly through COVID-19. So I'll be very surprised if we don't have an election this year.
Okay. And have a good government, we need a good opposition.
We do, but I think we have a good opposition.
Do you?
You know, I have a brother in politics. Is probably where you're going with this.
No. I'm not going there. I'm just in general. Do you think we've got a good opposition, and do you think we've got good government?
I do. I think as a country, we have a good government and a talented opposition, and you know, I think you know a level of you know you'll never get bipartisanship on you know every issue. We don't expect that. That's why we call them oppositions. But I think through COVID-19, you know, we've seen that when, you know, the going gets tough, we can operate as a, you know, as a single unit with the level of bipartisanship. So, and look, you know, for the opposition, that's probably worked against them, by doing the right thing. So to speak, because, you know, government, you know, winning government is as much about opposing as proposing. So we'll see. Look, I'm fairly indifferent to, you know, whoever is in government. You know, I'd like to think maybe naively that good policy is good policy. But it's up to us as business leaders to be able to help them form that policy and articulate the policy. You know, I learned a long time ago as a lobbyist and in council that there's no use bringing a problem to a politician without a solution. You need to say, Minister, we have a big problem here, but you can't just leave it there. You've got to say, Minister, we have a big problem here, and we think, or I think, this is the way we approach it. Now, they may not agree with that approach, but at least you're on the front foot. You know, you're proposing ideas rather than just simply dumping a problem in the lap of the government of the day.
And do you think our business leaders get engaged enough in that regard with, you know, the political discourse?
Look, I think they are, and I think on both sides, you know, I attend business functions on both, you know, major parties. I think they are, and I think they have a go. There'll always be philosophical, you know, differences. You know, my thinking, for example, on turning to the private sector to deliver many of the government's healthcare programs, there are people within, you know, certainly within the Labor Party who see that as, you know, the first nail in the coffin of Medicare. They shouldn't. It's not the privatisation of healthcare. It's just turning to the private sector to deliver the, you know, the products and services. So, you know, there will always be some philosophical opposition, which is just insurmountable.
Yeah.
But you've got to keep plugging away.
But how are you going to keep plugging away on 3-year terms, Mark? The governments don't stick around long enough quite often to, one, take your points on view. When you've got to win them over, hearts and minds, et cetera, and then we're going to implement it. They're gone in 3 years.
Well, we've had 3-year terms for a long time now, Greg.
Yeah, but as
a country, as a lucky country, we've made, you know, tremendous progress over the past, you know, 100 years and more. So, look, you know, as Churchill once said, you know, probably the worst system except for all the rest. So, look, I'm still the optimist. And, look, we probably exaggerate government's role in all of this. It's really up to leaders, be they business or community or social leaders, to get out there, create the ideas, and help government form the policy necessary to execute those ideas.
Role of sport in your life, how important is it?
I like my sport. You know, I like my rugby league, to a lesser extent, you know, rugby and AFL and cricket. You know, all my kids have been very sporty. My son plays for Newcastle Knights. You know, I'm very proud of, you know, his achievement. So, yeah, I get as nervous before a game as he probably does. So sport's important. Physical health is really important to me. I think, you know, I'm often saying to, you know, people I influence or coach or mentor, call it what you will, that it's important that they stay fit and healthy. It's good for your psychological health.
And your stress reliever? Is it the
one? Sport one beer and exercise.
No, what about the one beer? The one beer or one glass of wine a day?
Oh, yeah. My dad used to say, you know, you need a little bit of Christmas in every day. So I treat myself. And I think as you get older, I think you recognize that every day is valuable, and you can treat yourself and you shouldn't feel guilty about that. But I have Mondays off.
Okay, fair enough.
And I probably have more than one on a Friday and Saturday too. But okay. Honestly, three beers a day completely pulls me up.
Two last questions. If you're going to give one message out to all the young people out there, real simple question to you, Mark. Why should I take up health insurance?
Health insurance, I often say to people, you don't need it until you do. And so it's a form of security against the risk of disease and sickness. You will get, and this is, you know, I've been careful here because, you know, I don't want to create the spectre of a two-haired healthcare system, but you'd expect me to say you will get more prompt, more choice, and I think better care within the private system. So if you have the means, it's something which is highly valuable in terms of your personal and financial security. But what I want the future vision to be, in a way I've described today, is to be as much about, if you become a member of NIB, you'll be healthier because we'll provide you with the products, services and support and insight and content, which devices, the connectivity to, you know, IoT devices and symptom checkers and other wonderful technologies which are emerging, will connect you with those things in a way which will help you, you know, not only understand your risk profile, but better manage that risk profile.
And Mark, if you were to look back at that younger man building his career in Cessnock, what advice would you give him all these years later?
I don't think there's anything I'd change, Greg. Oh, there might be a few things in my personal life I'd change. I don't know what it's like for most others, but I recognize I'll be dead for billions of years. And every day I enjoy. I recognize that, you know, I've only got so many of these days. And I particularly, something my father used to say, which I share, is always be able to laugh at yourself, which I suppose just another way of saying, you know, don't take life too seriously or yourself, and keep things in perspective. You know, I often say to my kids, you know, well, when they're panicking over something, well, whose head's fallen off? Which I think I've done reasonably well. But certainly, as you get older, I think you have a greater sense of, you know, the beauty of life and the importance of every day to live it to its fullest. The importance of, you know, seizing every day when opportunity comes, and the importance of keeping things in perspective, and the importance of being able to laugh at yourself and, you know, accept your flaws without, you know, getting too down about it, or without it damaging your confidence about your ability to go forward.
On that, Mark, really appreciate you making the time to join us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
You've been listening to No Limitations.